Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. On February 20th, 2008, the Supreme Court decided Regal v. Medtronic. In Regal, the court held that the federal medical device amendment to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act preempts a state law claim seeking damages for injuries caused by medical devices that receive pre-market approval from the Food and Drug Administration. In this episode of SCOTUS Cast, Richard Negarita, a professor at Vanderbilt University Law School, discusses the case. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Negarita.
This is Professor Richard Negarita at Vanderbilt University Law School. I'm going to be talking today about the Supreme Court's decision in a case called Regal v. Medtronic. Regal is one of four preemption cases currently pending before the Supreme Court involving the relationship of federal product safety regulation, especially regulation by the Food and Drug Administration, to tort litigation under the common law of the various states. The Regal case, which the court decided last week, deals with FDA regulation of medical devices, specifically what are called Class 3 devices that undergo the most extensive and probing sort of pre-market approval by the FDA before they can be sold to the public. As the Supreme Court notes in its opinion in Regal, only a small percentage of medical devices undergo what can be described as full-scale pre-market review. Most of them undergo a much lighter touch sort of review, basically just to ask whether they're substantially equivalent to a device that's already on the market. Back in 1996, in an earlier case called Medtronic versus Lohr, the Supreme Court said that this less probing review, simply asking whether the device in question is substantially equivalent to something already on the market, that's not the sort of pre-market regulatory review that gives rise to preemption under the federal legislation concerning medical devices. On the other hand, full-scale pre-market review, which is what we have in Regal, entails the submission of information that's quite extensive by the manufacturer to the FDA. And the key point is that unlike the situation in the Lohr case in 1996, full-scale pre-market review, if the agency rules in the defendant's favor and allows the product on the market, a full-scale pre-market review results in the imposition of a requirement as a matter of federal law that the device, when it comes to the market, has to conform to the specifications regarding design, labeling, and so forth that were the basis for the FDA's pre-market approval. In plain English, the manufacturer has to design and label the medical device in exactly the way that it told the FDA it would in the course of getting approval to put the product on the market. Now, the device in the Regal case was a particular kind of catheter that was manufactured by the defendant, Medtronic. The physician of the plaintiff in this case, Charles Regal, had used the catheter made by Medtronic in connection with heart surgery on Mr. Regal. The catheter ruptured, resulting in quite serious harm to Mr. Regal. There are indications in the Supreme Court's opinion that there might well have been a lack of proper care in the use of a catheter on the part of Mr. Regal's doctor. The court notes, for example, that the label on the catheter said that it should not be used for patients with the sort of calcified coronary arteries from which Mr. Regal suffered. In addition, there are indications of possible excessive inflation of the catheter by the physician in the course of its use. The legal question in Regal, however, is whether the manufacturer, Medtronic, can be held liable in addition to any liability that might be imposed on Mr. Regal's doctor. The Supreme Court's opinion is a strong, lopsided majority in favor of the preemption argument that had been advanced by Medtronic here. The opinion is relatively straightforward in its structure, and despite some relatively alarmist opinions in the op-ed pages of some major newspapers, the Supreme Court's opinion in Regal does not carve out vastly new ground. Rather, it confirms the position that the overwhelming majority of lower courts had taken on this kind of preemption issue. The relevant statute here is the Medical Device Amendments of 1976. The medical device amendments include a provision that specifically addresses the relationship between federal law requirements imposed by the FDA and requirements imposed by way of state law. The relevant language in the statute provides that a state may not establish or continue in effect with regard to a medical device any requirement, that's the key word in the statute, any requirement which is different from or in addition to any requirement imposed by the FDA. Now, this statutory language makes a great deal of sense. It basically says that where you have a conflict between a federal law requirement imposed by the FDA and a requirement imposed by way of state law, of course, the federal requirement prevails. It is a specific preemption provision in the statute itself. So the first step in the Supreme Court's analysis is to figure out whether we have a federal law requirement. And here the court quite easily determines that this kind of full-scale pre-market approval for a medical device does impose a federal law requirement. As I mentioned, the requirement is basically a requirement on the manufacturer not to deviate from the approved design and labeling that supported the pre-market approval by the FDA in the first place. This first point was not dramatically contested in this litigation. The real point of disagreement came in the second step of the court's analysis, and that is to ask whether there is a state law requirement that is in conflict with the federal law requirement imposed by the FDA. And here, a lopsided majority of the court signs on to the proposition that liability imposed for defective design or inadequate warning pursuant to state common law does indeed impose a state law requirement within the meaning of the medical device amendments. So here we do have a conflict between a state law requirement and a federal law requirement, exactly the sort of conflict that the statutory language says must be resolved in favor of federal law. This was the major point of the debate in the litigation, as I mentioned. We have seven justices signing on to the majority opinion. In addition, Justice Stevens concurs in the result. The lone dissenter in this case is Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Justice Ginsburg argues in her dissenting opinion, with some plausibility, that there's no strong indication that Congress back in 1976 thought it was enacting a statute that would have a significant preemptive effect on state common law of torts. The problem for the anti-preemption view is the way that the common law of torts has come to be understood both in Supreme Court precedent and in scholarly circles today. The dominant view is to think of tort as a system of privatized regulation. This is a view that's heavily influenced by law and economics scholarship, written by such people as Judge Richard Posner, Judge Guido Calabresi, scholars like Kip Viscusi, and others. The law and economics view that thinks of tort primarily as a system of privatized regulation is certainly not the only view that one can find of tort law in the legal academy. Corrective justice scholars or civil recourse scholars think about tort law in a rather different way that places it less in tension with administrative agency regulation. But I dare say that the law and economics type of view is the view embraced by a substantial line of Supreme Court precedents in the preemption area. In the Lohr case back in 1996, the court ultimately did not rule in favor of the defendant's preemption argument in that case. But as part of the reasoning in Lohr, the justices in that earlier case did embrace the notion that liability imposed pursuant to state common law can indeed give rise to a state law requirement that might, in a future case, conflict with a federal law requirement. The one problem in Lohr for the defendant was that there was no federal law requirement imposed in the situation there. In addition, the Supreme Court points to another earlier preemption case, the Cipollone case, involving tobacco regulation, where again you have five justices signing on to the notion that liability imposed by way of state common law can give rise to a state law requirement. Well, what's notable about the result here in Regal? The first thing, it seems to me, is the lopsidedness, as I mentioned, of the outcome here. We have seven justices signing on to the majority opinion written by Justice Scalia. That majority includes the two most recent appointees to the court, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. This is really the first major preemption case that they've heard. They sign on to the pro-preemption view. Justice Ginsburg, as I mentioned, is the only dissenter. Even Justice Stevens, who in many other cases has been relatively unsympathetic to preemption arguments, even Justice Stevens at least concurs in the result in Regal. Justice Stevens says, well, Justice Ginsburg might well be right about the circumstances of the statute, but the fact is that the word requirement here, the key language of the statute, clearly encompasses common law liability. There's no way to work around the meaning of that language in the statute, says Justice Stevens. There are two other points of note in the reasoning in the majority opinion that I think would offer encouragement to manufacturers in advancing preemption arguments in the future. One of those points has to do with the role of juries in state tort litigation. Writing for the majority, Justice Scalia signs on to a key argument that's often made by defendants in the preemption context. Justice Scalia says, out of all the state institutions, state legislatures, state administrative agencies, or juries impaneled in state tort litigation, do we really think that the jury is the appropriate kind of institution to evaluate the kinds of complex cost-benefit trade-offs that are involved with regard to medical devices, or for that matter, prescription drugs? The jury sees only one situation. The jury has before it only the bad outcome in this particular case. They don't see any human face to reinforce the notion of all the positive outcomes, the beneficial outcomes that might result from having this particular device on the market. The jury, in other words, out of all the possible institutions for making state law, is not an institution well suited toward evaluating the sort of cost-benefit trade-offs here. In addition, the majority gives relatively little weight, basically no weight, to the so-called presumption against preemption, at least when there's a preemption provision in the underlying statute. In this situation, in the Medical Device Act, amendments, we have such a preemption provision in the statute. The preemption question is treated by the majority as simply a matter of statutory interpretation. There's no weight given to the so-called presumption against preemption. It's featured prominently in Justice Ginsburg's dissenting opinion, but it's not discussed in any substantial degree by the majority. If you have a preemption provision in the statute, there's no particular presumption one way or another. The court's job is simply to interpret the statute. Now, there's one point of note that I think might offer a bit of encouragement to tort plaintiffs here and might be a bit of a disappointment for manufacturers advancing preemption arguments in future cases. In the course of the majority's opinion, there's a reference to a significant issue that has arisen in a number of preemption contexts. In recent years, the Bush administration and the FDA have developed a practice of submitting amicus briefs to support preemption arguments made by defendants in tort litigation. Indeed, the FDA has gone on to take a strongly pro-preemption view in many of its underlying rulemakings in recent years. The question that this presents is what degree of deference, or at least respect, in administrative law parlance, what degree of deference or respect do the courts owe to the FDA's own view of the statute, which at least in the current administration is a strongly preemptive view of the statute? Writing for the majority in Regal, Justice Scalia says we don't need to get into the deference question. We don't need to decide it definitively in this case because the statutory language is clear. But then, just as soon as the majority says that, there is a reference to, in the court's opinion, to the notion that perhaps mere Skidmore respect might well be the appropriate framework within which to analyze the agency's position. that is something less than full-scale Chevron deference in the parlance of administrative law. Now, again, this is a passage that is dicta in Regal. The court does not nail down the question of whether Chevron deference or Skidmore respect, or perhaps even some lesser degree of regard for the agency's position, is definitely the appropriate approach here. And so we don't have a definitive ruling on this point. The question of what deference or respect is owed to the FDA's view is a point that will come up again in another case before the court, I believe it's going to be argued next term, called Wyeth versus Levine. The Wyeth case deals not with medical devices, but rather with the world of prescription drug labeling, a very significant area in which state tort liability has been a matter of serious concern to manufacturers for some time. The question of what to make of the agency's own pro-preemption position is a significant issue in Wyeth versus Levine, and I think we'll have to wait till next term when the court takes up that case in full to find out what position the court will ultimately take on this question of administrative law in the preemption context. But I think the bottom line here in Regal is a big victory for defendant manufacturers, and one that reinforces, at least in the particular context of Regal, the position that had been taken by the vast majority of lower courts in this country.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.